From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Thursday's scheduled vote on Judge Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination is up in the air. The Bay Area professor accusing the judge of sexually assaulting her says she's willing to testify about the alleged incident before the committee. Kavanaugh denies the event took place, says he'll answer questions about it as well. We'll look at the many complex aspects of the developments right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA with attendance only twice per term. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. I so appreciate your starting this Monday with us here on 89.3 and KPCC.org. Later on the program, the ongoing debate over government-sanctioned drug injection sites. A recent meta-analysis of research concludes the sites don't reduce overdoses. However, many in the public health community want more needle exchanges and safe places to inject. In Orange County, a lawsuit's been filed to stop the program that's underway in Santa Ana. We'll talk about that later on the program. But first, the Senate Judiciary Committee is facing how to handle an allegation of sexual assault against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Palo Alto University professor Christine Blasey Ford claims Kavanaugh held her down, groped her, and tried to forcibly remove her clothes before she escaped. She alleges the incident occurred at a private home when she and Kavanaugh were teenagers. Ford also claims Kavanaugh and a friend of his, she says, was in the room at the time, were extremely drunk. The accuser's attorney hit the morning talk shows to talk about her client's willingness to tell her story. Here's Deborah Katz.
She's willing to do what she needs to do. She is willing to hopefully tell her story in a manner that is a fair proceeding. Unfortunately, what we're already hearing this morning is that the Republicans intend to play hardball. They intend to grill her.
This was on CBS This Morning, attorney Deborah Katz. Meanwhile, White House advisor Kellyanne Conway talked about the accusation this morning on the cable news show Fox and Friends.
Well, this woman should not be insulted and she should not be ignored. I think the Senate is headed to a reasonable approach in that it seems to me, and speaking to a few senators, including Senator Lindsey Graham, that allowing this woman to be heard in sworn testimony, allowing Judge Kavanaugh to be heard in sworn testimony about these specific allegations would be added to the very considerable mountain of evidence and considerations that folks will have when they weigh whether or not to vote for Judge Kavanaugh to be on the Supreme Court.
So the question is, how is the Judiciary Committee going to handle this? Thursday, they were scheduled to do their committee vote on the confirmation of the judge before it was passed on to the full Senate. At this point, though, it's sounding more and more like there is going to be a public hearing at which both the accuser and Judge Kavanaugh will be making their statements. Once again, the judge has denied that such an incident took place, said over the course of his life he has never behaved in the way described in the story that was reported exclusively this weekend in the Washington Post. Joining us to talk about what comes next in the confirmation process, USC professor of political science and chair of gender studies, Ange Marie Hancock Alfaro. Professor, good to have you with us.
Great to be back, Larry.
So what do you think is the best way for the committee to now handle this?
Well, I think the committee has to give a fair hearing to Professor Ford, I believe it is, who's come forward. I think the one question is whether or not it should be broadcast. or whether it should be what was called a staff hearing. And so I think, you know, going forward, I think they have to broadcast it because in this era, it's not possible to want to have this behind closed doors. And of course, as the accused, you know, recalling Judge Kavanaugh would then make the process, I think, fair in terms of having both sides.
And does it make sense, do you think, to do this before there's any FBI investigation into the claim, an effort to interview people that might have been at the house where the incident is supposed to have taken place to try and see if there's any corroboration for Professor Ford's account?
Well, part of the issue is that should have been done a while ago as part of the background check. But certainly trying to have this conversation right now, if, in fact, the leaders of the of Judiciary Committee want to actually hold the vote, there's no way you can hold the vote, I don't think, without actually having this particular hearing. So I think the investigation ends up suffering, don't get me wrong, from the FBI. But I don't think that the Judiciary Committee is willing to wait until the results of an FBI investigation would actually be complete. I don't think that the leaders, that Chuck Grassley would be willing to wait that long.
Lonnie Chen, research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. He advised the Rubio 2016 presidential campaign and the Romney 2012 presidential campaign. He served as policy director. Lonnie, good to have you with us again. If you were chairing the committee, what would you do?
Well, Larry, I certainly believe that it's important for both the accuser and for Judge Kavanaugh to have the opportunity to fully discuss the charges and the situation. Obviously, it's a very serious set of accusations, and the accuser needs to be heard. My concern about an open hearing is simply the spectacle nature of these hearings and what they've become. They've become opportunities for grandstanding. We saw that with Senator Booker during the first round of Kavanaugh hearings. We've seen it with Republican senators in past hearings as well. So it just seems to me that the best way to handle this is indeed to have a hearing of some sort. For that hearing, perhaps, though, to be closed initially, and if any issues arise during that closed hearing, then potentially to air those things publicly. But, you know, we all know in this day and age anyway, Larry, everything leaks from Washington to places like a sieve anyway. So whatever happens in that closed setting, we'll likely get wind of it. I just don't want it to be turned into a public spectacle, which would be an embarrassment both to the accuser as well as to the judge. But certainly the Judiciary Committee needs to have a process through which these charges are fully aired and for Judge Kavanaugh to say his piece as well.
Well, I also wonder about the effect of the process on the participants. For Professor Ford, who did not want to come forward for fear of how this would upend her life and the kinds of accusations that would come her way, she now is going to be in this, you know, most public of all settings. She is going to be challenged, certainly, as to her credibility and the details that she gave in the Washington Post interview. This has the potential, of course, to psychologically, you know, be difficult for her. And I understand, you know, she is a psychology professor. She's as aware of that as anybody. But the other part is for Republicans, they have to be very wary of how they challenge her because of how that's going to appear.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly there are difficulties on both sides. But obviously, the goal here is to illuminate what happened. Now, this is very difficult. We're talking about activity that occurred, you know, 3 decades ago, and memories and recollections tend to get foggy over those many years, both on the part of Judge Kavanaugh as well as on part of Professor Ford. So I think that the challenge here is how do you get to the bottom of what happened? There was a reference earlier to the FBI investigation, a background investigation that happens of all high-level appointees, and you would have expected some of this to at least have been ferreted out during the investigation. So it's a question of why it wasn't. Certainly, I think Senator Feinstein deserves some blame here for really badly mishandling this important piece of information.
So how should she have handled it when she received – when this was passed on from, I believe it was Congresswoman Eshoo, she receives it. How should Senator Feinstein have dealt with it in your view?
Well, if indeed what she was going to do was to refer it to the FBI for further investigation, she should have referred it immediately. She should not have waited until, we were 1 week out from the vote to refer it then. If she had referred it earlier, the FBI could have conducted its investigation fully and done so with proper anonymity for the accuser as well. The FBI does this all the time when they conduct these sorts of investigations. They receive information about candidates. And generally when you do a background investigation for anybody, I've done a lot of these. I've been the subject of a background investigation. People are asked for, is there anybody else I should talk to? Is there anything else I should know? They try to be as extensive as they can. And certainly in this situation, it seems to me the right thing to have done would have been to refer immediately to law enforcement and then allow law enforcement the opportunity to have exercised its due diligence.
Let me bring in a law enforcement voice to join us in conversation with Lonnie and Ange-Marie. Luke William Hunt is assistant professor of criminal justice at Radford University in Virginia. He's a former FBI special agent and supervisory special agent in both Charlottesville, Virginia and Washington, D.C. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, in the kind of in-depth background checks that Judge Kavanaugh would have, if there was a pattern of behavior like this, what is the degree of likelihood that would be exposed in the background check?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think just to put this into context, it shows the importance of the just very basic investigation that has to occur. A lot of times we think of these high-level nominees as, having a sit-down with the president and a one-on-one vetting. But really it comes down to knocking on doors by the FBI agents. And they're trying to really determine two things. One is suitability. And so that gets to the candidate's character, traits, their integrity, and then also security, whether they're a true and loyal citizen of the U.S. Now, the latter is going to be less relevant here, I think, with someone with Kavanaugh's history that's sort of been verified. But when you get down to looking at someone's suitability, that is really going to be a matter of developing leads. So if you go to someone's college, you're going to talk to their roommates, and this one particular roommate may not have any damning information or anything like that. But as the other person on the panel said, that might lead to additional leads that you have to go investigate. Now, the issue here, in addition to the time frame, we've got my understanding that there are only a few people at this party. Did you get a good sample of Kavanaugh's associates in high school that would have knowledge about this? Regardless, we now have new information. That means we have new leads that need to be investigated by the FBI.
And I guess my question is, if you have potentially, and this is only alleged, of course, but a single incident versus someone who's a serial offender, I just assume, a serial offender, it's going to be easier. There are more potential people exposed to the behavior. But if you've got a one-time experience, as is alleged here, that's got, and particularly with a small group, that's got to be a much more of a challenge for those doing a background check.
Absolutely. And that's my point, that sometimes these things can fall through the cracks in that way. I mean, again, you may talk to some people and maybe they tell some drinking stories or something like that. But if you don't hit that right friend or that right person that's listed on the security questionnaire and it doesn't develop into some leads to other people, then if it's a one-time or a one-off thing, in which we don't know, of course, you may very well miss some information, and you're going to have to go back now that we've got this new lead to investigate.
How long would an investigation like this typically take, or is that even impossible to say?
An extremely long time, particularly with someone like this who's worked in a variety of high-level positions, educated around the country, months and months. Now, to be sure, this has been happening throughout his career, and sometimes you can sort of add to that. But at a minimum, you have to go back and verify the very basic character, suitability, and security questions. And I think maybe to get to your specific question, though, to follow up on this very narrow set of new revelations, that's going to be obviously at the top, the most prioritized thing the Bureau has going on. And I would think they could have that done relatively quickly, considering that it seems to be constrained to a small group of people, unless, of course, that leads to other new leads that gets bigger and bigger.
And if the individuals if they could track down, first of all, if this event occurred, if they're able to find individuals who were there when the incident occurred, but they refused to cooperate, what would be the next step?
Well, I mean, what you basically do when an FBI agent or an investigator goes out, they're going to speak to these people and they're going to record the statements in their FD-302, which is their written formal record of the interview. And that's the evidence of your background investigation. And so that's going to stand against Professor Ford's statement. And you're just going to have to weigh that evidence. You know, you're going to have competing versions of what happens, and it's going to be up to the people who decide to determine which testimony gets the most weight.
We're talking with Luke William Hunt of Radford University in Virginia, where he's assistant professor of criminal justice. He was an FBI special agent and a supervisory special agent for a number of years, talking with us about background checks that the FBI conducts. And in a case like this, where Senator Feinstein referred the letter which contains the accusation by the Palo Alto University professor, how long it might take for the FBI to interview individuals who might have any knowledge about the alleged incident. We're at 866-893-KPCC. If you have any questions about this later in the hour, we'll open up the phones to hear your thoughts about how you think the Senate Judiciary Committee should proceed with this in the wake of the woman making the allegation now being public about her identity and saying that she's willing to tell her story before the Judiciary Committee. Tear Talk on 89.3 KPCC, back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope you're having a good start to your work week. Coming up in our second hour, we'll talk about earthquake insurance. According to the most recent survey, only about 13% of California homeowners have it. So the question is, if there's a catastrophic quake in California in the near term, what happens financially, not just to the homeowner, but to governmental agencies which might be called on to bail out homeowners who've lost their homes or had them significantly damaged? We'll look at the economic impact of that. Joining us now to talk about what's going on, a very busy day in Washington, D.C., in the wake of the allegations of sexual assault against Judge Kavanaugh, is Bloomberg News White House reporter Shannon Pettypiece. Shannon, good to have you with us.
Thanks.
So first of all, I know a lot's going on. Judge Kavanaugh at the White House earlier. You've got Susan Collins saying that they need to hear Professor Ford's account and Judge Kavanaugh's account. Are we getting much closer to there being a public hearing involving both?
I don't know if we're getting much closer to a public hearing. I think what might be most likely at this point is some sort of private hearing or a private phone call between Kavanaugh, between the and the committee, the accuser and committee members. That, as of last night, was the option that the White House officials who I talked to were leaning towards, some sort of private conversation, private phone call. They would obviously really much like to avoid any public hearing, because once you get into a public hearing, you don't know what can happen. You know, people can come off very sympathetic on TV, very credible on TV. So the real effort was to at least avoid a public hearing. But they are sensitive to the fact that they don't want to make it sound like this accuser shouldn't be heard from or this accuser's voice shouldn't be out there. Kellyanne Conway came on today and, you know, rather than attacking the accuser, which is something we have seen this White House do in the past, you know, she said that she thinks the accuser should be listened to. They should be, taken, I don't know if she said credibly, but, you know, their account should be included in this conversation, but they would definitely prefer that be in a private form.
Yeah, and she said that Professor Ford should not be attacked. I wonder, is there a lot of breath-holding in D.C. over what President Trump might tweet about this?
Right. There certainly was yesterday an anticipation that this could be among his 6 a.m. round of tweet conversations. We did not see that. I mean, nobody admits to being able to control his tweets and what he tweets at any moment. And even if there is a conversation and discussion about not tweeting something, he can still go ahead and change his mind and tweet it. You know, he feels he is his own best messenger. He is his own best communications director. And he's the one who has the final say on whether or not he's going to weigh in on and launch some sort of attack or not. So that's still definitely a possibility. As far as breath holding, I think there's also a lot of breath holding to see if there's any other accusers that come out. If there's sort of this 24-hour, 48-hour window, people were saying that if there's someone else out there who has a similar story, this is the time to come forward. Right now, they're still trying to get a vote by Thursday, even if that might seem unlikely. So you have a few days if you're out there and you want to speak up. And so that's sort of the real breath holding right now, is to see if anyone else comes out, because they admit that that could be very damaging if there's more people who come out with similar stories.
How much is the Clarence Thomas confirmation process with Anita Hill's accusations coming up in Washington? Are people making comparisons?
So certainly Republicans aren't, and certainly Democrats are very much. I heard one Democratic strategist raise the point that, well, we'll have two people on the Supreme Court now who were accused of sexual misconduct, or whatever you want to refer to it as, and what type of message does that send? Republicans see no comparison here. They say this is something that happened 3 decades ago. There's no contemporaneous, witnesses. And, there's actually one witness who denies it. So they are focused on, sort of finding the holes in this story, and then just saying that there's really no way to know. He denies it. She says it. So they then turn it into a he said, she said argument, and that, well, we really just can't know. But we have no reason not to believe him as just as much as the accuser. So that's where Republicans come down on this.
Well, and are they sort of arguing both ends of it? It sounds like, if I understood you correctly, they're sort of looking at the argument defending the denial by Judge Kavanaugh that, without any corroborating evidence, we believe him, this didn't happen. But then the separate issue, well, if this did happen, it should not be disqualifying a single incident when he's 17 years old. Are they arguing both?
Yeah, I mean, it's very complex. And I should say, when I say Republicans, I can't speak obviously for all Republicans, because there are some Republicans on the Hill, Jeff Flake, who've raised a bit more concern about this. But within the White House, within the president's allies and the people who are speaking publicly about this, yes, there is. They admit that this is complicated, that this is a real tricky one. This is from a long, if it's true, you open up the question of, well, do we hold something that someone did as a teenager at a drunken party against them for the rest of their life? They also argue, though, that they don't, there's a lot of questions as to why they wouldn't believe this is true, and that he's come out and very forcefully denied it. That there could have been, maybe other explanations for this, maybe a mistaken identity, or a woman remembered the wrong person, or they feel like there's so much they don't know. So the kind of argument is to say this is not necessarily a clear-cut case. And for them, really, the president's allies and the people in the White House, they believe Judge Kavanaugh at this point, and they have not seen enough evidence from this accuser to change their minds at this point.
Well, and as you say, it's so complicated, because then there's the issue of, if the alleged event happened and Judge Kavanaugh was as drunk as Professor Ford describes, the question would be, what if any memory he himself would have of the event if it did occur?
Right. It's incredibly complicated. Could he even remember? I mean, and it's incredibly complicated. And that's why I think it's hard for Republicans on this committee to really decide what to do, even putting aside partisan politics. I think there's a lot of members on this committee who are really struggling with this right now, because it is so complex. And I think the one of the solutions proposed was just to, to delay the vote to slow things down a little bit. But then you get on a slippery slope where, you delay, and then do you get this, do you lose the momentum to get this confirmed? But I think both people on both sides that I've talked to about this agree this is a complex situation. It's not clear cut in some ways, and that's making it, hard to tell where this is going to come down.
Shannon, before I let you go, I also wonder about the fact that the professor has said that she would like to see the effect of the claim that she's making stop the confirmation process for Judge Kavanaugh. She is a Democrat. She is against him being confirmed. Does that factor into the equation at all from the perspective of people in Washington?
I don't think so, but I think it's if it had been, since Republicans control the committee, I don't think it will influence Republicans. If it had been the other way around, though, where she said, this happened, but, I've forgiven it. It had been the other way around where she said this happened. I thought this should be out there, but I understand that he was a young man at the time. This shouldn't be held against him. I think that could have had an effect to give people some cover to say, yes, this is out there. He admits it as a mistake, if he admitted it at all. But we shouldn't hold this against him, and the accuser's not holding it against him. If it had gone that way, I think it could have helped give people some cover to get him through the confirmation process. But right, her, saying she thinks this should stop the confirmation process gives some leverage to Democrats to say, listen, we need to, we stop this. We can't go forward with this.
Shannon, thanks so much. Appreciate your talking with us today.
Thank you.
Bloomberg News White House reporter Shannon Pettypiece with us on Air Talk. Also joining us is Drexel University Associate Professor of Law, Lisa Tucker. Professor Tucker, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Larry.
So you were paying close attention during the time of the Clarence Thomas confirmation process, how the public so, cued into this. What are your thoughts about the potential impact of this allegation on the confirmation process?
Well, first, I want to note something that Shannon said, and that seems that Judge Kavanaugh is not contesting, and that is the fact that if this happened, it was because he was basically blackout drunk when he was 17 years old in high school. If we think back to 1987 with Doug Ginsburg's nomination, his nomination was withdrawn by the White House because he admitted that as an adult he had smoked marijuana. So one single illegal act, Judge Ginsburg was taken out of the running. And, of course, that is when Anthony Kennedy got his seat. So now here we are 31 years later, and it seems absolutely conclusive that Judge Kavanaugh committed a similar illegal offense in terms of an illegal use of a substance. And yet we're saying, well, if the accuser, if we can't prove the accuser, then maybe it's okay. So it's interesting to me that no one is focusing in on that part.
Well, I must have missed him saying that there was an incident like this when he was drunk. I thought he gave a categorical denial of it.
Everyone is saying, as you said to Shannon, everyone is saying, well, the alternate explanation is if this happened, maybe he doesn't remember it because he was drunk.
Yeah.
His friend, who she says was there, has said that he was blackout drunk on many occasions. So if that were to be the case, I think that would be very interesting.
Yeah. But I wonder if at this point you had, using your marijuana analogy, if someone illegally used marijuana as a minor today, whether that would be disqualifying for a justice. I question that it would be today. What do you think?
I don't know. I think that, this is where we are. 27 years later after Thomas and Hill, and, that's what we were about to go in on, and with Kavanaugh and Professor Ford, I think that if we were to flip-flop those two times, if it were Justice Thomas who were now up for who had been nominated to the Supreme Court, I think we might see that handled extremely differently, and there might be an extremely different outcome, given that at least some people seem to be taking you know, this fairly seriously against Judge Kavanaugh.
We're talking with Drexel University School of Law professor Lisa Tucker, joining us from Philadelphia. I'd love to hear from you as an Air Talk listener. There's so many complexities to the allegation. You know, we've talked about some of them. And my question for you is, what would you do if you were in charge of the Senate Judiciary Committee? What do you think is the best way to handle this case? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll continue our conversation right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up in our second hour, we'll look at the ongoing controversy over government-provided safe places for people to inject drugs. The public health view of this is that it cuts down on overdoses, that if someone does accidentally overdose, they're able to give them the drug, which can help to counter the effects of that. Also, that people are going to be using needles in a safer way and avoiding serious illness. So that's the many in the public health community make that argument. However, a recent meta-analysis of research into the safe injection sites claims that it doesn't show that it cuts down on overdoses, nor that it cuts down on the needle exchange that goes on of users sharing needles. So we'll take up that issue, as well as Orange County's lawsuit against a needle exchange program that's going on in Santa Ana, which has created controversy there. Right now, our focus is on the allegation that Judge Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted a teenage girl back in the 1980s. The allegation is coming from now a professor at Palo Alto University, which is a school of psychology in the San Francisco Bay Area. She claims, Christine Blasey Ford, that Judge Kavanaugh, at a party in which she claims that the then around 17-year-old Kavanaugh was extremely drunk, that he held her down. First of all, that she came out of a bathroom, he grabbed her, took her into a bedroom, held her down, groped her over her clothing, attempted to remove a swimsuit that she had on. I wasn't sure it was under her clothing or not, but trying to take that off of her. And says only the fact that he was so drunk that she was able to get away from him. And a friend of Kavanaugh, she says, was in the room at the time and extremely drunk as well. It was only their drunkenness that enabled her to be able to fight them off and to be able to leave the house where this gathering of teenagers was occurring. We're talking about what the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is in the midst of the confirmation process for Judge Kavanaugh, what it should do now. So my question for you as an Air Talk listener is, how do you think the committee should handle this? Should both the professor and the judge give their accounts? Judge Kavanaugh's denied that any such incident took place. Should the FBI be given more time to do a background check? Should the Judiciary Committee just move forward with a confirmation vote? What is your view about this? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're also talking with Lisa Tucker, Drexel University in Philadelphia. She's a professor of law. Professor, take us back to the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings. And what's your sense of any lingering effect that those open, public, televised hearings had on the court?
Well, I think that there are a couple of lingering effects, some positive, some negative. I think that the negative effects are probably that any woman coming forward after Anita Hill would recognize that she could be subject to not only very, very extreme public scrutiny, but probably criticism and worse today in the internet age when people say anything and everything on the internet. So I think that Anita Hill really, almost made it harder for women because people saw how horribly she was treated. At the same time, we know that sexual harassment really entered the public consciousness in a much different way after Professor Hill testified. And so to that extent, I think that what we would see if there is a public hearing with Professor Ford and with Judge Kavanaugh, we're going to see a lot more respect from the senators who are questioning her. Whether that's real respect or not, I can't say. Certainly there are a lot of people already who are questioning her truthfulness. But I think that outwardly we will not see the same kind of hearing where, you know, Professor Hill was being, you know, almost called names and treated with real skepticism and being cross-examined in a way that was very uncomfortable for people.
And yet in this case, at least given the account that was in the Washington Post over the weekend, Professor Ford was not able to detail where the house was located, how she got there, how she left. There were a number of other details that typically would go toward corroborating someone's story, additional specificity beyond the traumatic event that she alleges. And so,
right. And I think that one thing that came out after the Clarence Thomas hearings was that fact that many people thought that expert witnesses should have been called before the Senate to talk about what sexual harassment is and why women might react a certain way. For example, that was said that Professor Hill had driven him to the airport at one point after he made these advances towards her. And so it might very well be that an expert witness here could be useful in talking about women who have experienced sexual assault and what they typically do remember or block out. From my understanding, and I'm an expert on the court, not on sexual assault, but from my understanding, it's quite common for women to forget big pieces of things.
Do you think that this should be a televised open event, Professor?
I do, and here's why. Professor Ford has indicated her own willingness to do so. If she were uncomfortable doing that, I think it would be important to listen to her. But she has said, yes, I'm willing to do this. Judge Kavanaugh is asking for an appointment, a lifetime appointment, to a court where he will have huge power for the rest of his life. And if he isn't willing to be scrutinized by senators in front of their constituents, then I think that raises a real question about whether his denial of this, whether he's concerned that people will believe him.
All right. We're talking with professor at Drexel University in Philadelphia, associate professor of law, Lisa Tucker. Again, I'd like to hear from you how you would handle this if you were chairing the Senate Judiciary Committee, if you were a member of that committee. What would you be advocating that it does as part of the confirmation process of Judge Kavanaugh? Let me share some more listener comments. Obama Yoda writes on the page, the Senate must not muzzle Christine Blasey Ford and prevent her from giving sworn testimony before the committee and all of America. To do otherwise is to demonstrate the cheap short-term goal of filling a Supreme Court seat is paramount to the future of American democracy, and the Senate will have failed to fulfill constitutional responsibility to properly vet nominees. Astrogoth writes on the page, I think the key to the issue is the good friend who ended the slap and tickle fight or the rape in progress. We will never know which, but he does. Somebody should ask him. Well, the friend, Mark Judge, I believe is his name, he has denied that such an incident occurred as well. According to the allegation, the only other two individuals, aside from Ms. Ford, who were in the room, were Kavanaugh and Judge. Those were the only two. And they have both denied that the incident took place. So, Professor Tucker, is it likely that Mr. Judge would be subpoenaed to testify?
that's certainly a possibility. And I think that it's important to remember that. If I'm correct, I think the statute of limitations has expired on if this were an attempted rape or a sexual assault. And so really think about it. What do these men have to lose by denying it? Kavanaugh, if they can't prove it, he likely will get through and he'll have his seat on the Supreme Court. Judge, he'll just say, I didn't do it. There's not enough evidence. If, in fact, it came out that they were lying, Kavanaugh's in no worse position than he is right now, and Judge can't be prosecuted, and he's already written about having been, you know, had an alcohol addiction where he had blackouts. So, of course, they're going to lie right now if, in fact, they're lying. There's no advantage to telling the truth for either of them right now if the truth is that an assault did occur.
All right, 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Joan in Altadena said, I would ask Judge Kavanaugh to resign and withdraw his nomination. There's just been too much controversy around his character and his ability to tell the truth. But the problem is, if he didn't commit this act, why should he resign? If he knows that he didn't do it, that if the allegation is completely wrong, incorrect, that if it didn't happen, then why would he pull himself from the nomination? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in just 1 minute. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We're talking about the aftermath of the incident alleged by a Bay Area psychology professor that she was sexually assaulted by young Brett Kavanaugh when he would have been about 17 years old. I believe she would have been about 15 at the time. She alleged the incident occurred at a gathering of teenagers at a private home. And no adults were present at the time. She alleges that Kavanaugh, when she came out of a bathroom at the house, pulled her into a bedroom. He was there, she alleges, with a friend of his, Mark Judge, that Kavanaugh put his body on top of her, held her down, and that he groped her, attempted to remove her swimsuit, and that it was only the awkwardness of Kavanaugh and his friend that she was able to fight herself free and to run out of the home. So the question is, what now does the Senate Judiciary Committee do with this, what's described here, a very traumatic event for the girl at the time, and to try and get at the truth of what actually happened, asking you what you would do about this. Now, Sharon, in Studio City, how would you handle this?
Well, I would stop using the word alleged, even though it's legally necessary, because there's not a woman in her right mind who would come out and make this statement if it was not true, unless she was some type of woman who's desperately in need of money and going to get it for doing so. This is absolutely crazy that people think that she would do this with nothing to gain.
Well, I think it's a little more complex than that, Sharon, because I think there are people who hold the view that it's possible to recall events in a different way than they actually occurred. So you make a strong point that if this was actually plotted on her part to raise a completely false accusation that she knew was false and was knowingly make a false accusation, she's taking on a lot of grief to do that. Your point's absolutely correct. But the question is this even if she believes it, is this really what happened and in the way that she describes? And so that's, Sharon, isn't that the challenge to get to that? So just because she believed it happened doesn't mean it happened.
I can assure you, no one forgets an incident like that, no matter how long they live.
All right, Sharon, appreciate your call. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Anjumarie Hancock Alfaro, Professor of Political Science and Chair of Gender Studies at USC. So, Professor, we've been talking for this past hour about the challenge that the committee faces. If you were in the position of chairing the committee, what would you do? Professor? No? All right, Lonnie Chen, let me go back to you. Lonnie, you know, given the public debate that's going on at this point, how do you think the committee is going to end up handling this?
Well, first of all, I think they have to move forward quickly to try to adjudicate what happened. And what we've decided here, obviously, and it seems to be the case that a lot of people agree with this, is that it's tough to adjudicate something that happened 30 years ago. But certainly the first step, it seems to me, is to try and have Professor Ford have the opportunity to tell her story to the senators who are going to be making this decision, for Judge Kavanaugh to be able to have a venue to respond. I've said before, I think that needs to be done in a private session of the committee initially, and then they can evaluate going forward. I understand that there's some reporting this morning that Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee are resisting the notion of there being conversations set up between members of the committee or committee staff and Professor Ford and Judge Kavanaugh. I think that's unfortunate if that reporting is indeed true, because part of what needs to happen here is we need to be moving as quickly as possible to determine exactly what elements of this story can be corroborated, what elements of Judge Kavanaugh's denial are truthful or not. I think all this needs to happen as soon as possible. So I would hope, if I were on the committee or had any role to play on the committee, that there'd be an effort to try and get this aired out as quickly as possible.
All right. And what do you see as the potential political repercussions of this? So if this is a public hearing, and if Professor Ford comes across as highly credible and is able, you know, to describe in detail what she alleges happened to her, and you know, people across the country are watching and hearing this, does, you know, what effect does that have, not just in terms of what happens with Kavanaugh, but what happens in the midterm elections? Could this do serious damage to Republicans?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question there are political implications here. But let's not lose sight of the more important thing here, first of all, which is that the accusations are serious. The accusations need to be heard out in a venue that is not a sideshow. And my concern about these public hearings is that they have become a sideshow. If you look at the hearings that we've been through for the last several Supreme Court nominees, it is an opportunity for members of the United States Senate who are running for president or thinking about running for president to have their platform to showboat, in essence. And I don't think that's what we need to have. We need to have a serious discussion around these accusations, and the venue for that needs to be kept in mind. So that's the first thing. The second thing is politically, you know, it's very difficult to say what the implications are. It's a very difficult political situation as it stands now for Republicans who are running in this election. Obviously, they're all being faced with questions about how to handle this, and it's a very delicate situation. The implications, if the accusations bear to be true, and there is reason once those accusations are tested that they're true, I think clearly you know, Republicans should be forcefully on the side of the fact that this kind of behavior cannot stand, and that has implications for Judge Kavanaugh's nomination.
So
what the White House says about it.
You don't buy the argument that I've heard from some. Well, if it happened, he was 17 years old. If there hadn't been any repeat of that, that shouldn't be disqualifying. It sounds like you're saying you do think it would be disqualifying.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, I'm a parent. I think a lot of people who are parents of boys, you ask yourself, is this the kind of behavior you want to say is okay just because someone's in high school? And I would say the answer to that is no. So, yeah, I mean, look, if these accusations end up to be verified, I think it's a big problem. Absolutely.
And how could President Trump weighing in on this have an effect on the proceedings?
Well, President Trump is going to weigh in whether it's helpful or not. My sense is that the president will continue to stand behind Judge Kavanaugh, and whether that helps or hurts, you know, Republicans who are running for Congress this year, it's a very difficult scenario to game out. It kind of depends on where these people are running and what the president's popularity is. But my guess is the president's going to do what he's going to do independent of the political considerations of whether it's good for Republicans or not.
Lonnie, thanks so much. We appreciate it. Have a very good week. Thanks for being with us. Stanford University research fellow at the Hoover Institution, Lonnie Chen, with us. Advisor to Marco Rubio's 2016 2016 presidential run and policy advisor for the Romney 2012 campaign. Ansh Marie Hancock Alfaro, professor of political science at USC, joining us, and thanks to all of our guests over the course of this hour. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, we're going to spend considerable time looking at safe injection and needle exchange programs. We'll find out what's going on, the latest here in California.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. A solar water heating system doesn't replace your existing natural gas water heater. Instead, it helps by preheating the water with the warmth of the sun to help you use less energy. When you install a system at your home, you'll still have the hot water your family relies on for baths, showers, and laundry. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover nearly half the system's cost. It's the strength of the sun in your home. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. Offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by October 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's off to a good start. Coming up, we'll talk about the move towards safe injection facilities. These are supervised facilities that various cities are looking at establishing, where drug users can go inject. If they accidentally overdose, that they could be treated immediately on site. Also, the idea that this would cut down on the use of shared dirty needles, which could lead to serious illnesses like hepatitis, HIV, etc. Well, the Justice Department says that it's going to take legal action against those facilities. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein says that even with city leaders desperate to curb mounting overdose deaths, this is not an acceptable way to proceed. We've also got in Orange County a needle exchange that is creating all kinds of controversy in Santa Ana, and a lawsuit there that the county is filing against the needle exchange that are there. So we'll talk about public health efforts to intervene with IV drug users and the complexities of that. But first, we take a look at earthquake insurance, which a vast minority of California homeowners pay each year. That means that they're potentially exposed to huge losses in the event of a major earthquake. Traditional homeowners insurance does not cover for earthquake damage. A study that's coming out very soon from R Street Institute, a free market think tank, claims that the implications of a major earthquake in California are huge for the federal government. The argument being that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have a large number of the mortgages of California homes that are uninsured, putting the federal government on the hook for huge expenses if those homes are damaged and destroyed. With us to talk about the study is R.J. Lehman, co-author of the report, Take a Load Off Fannie, the GSEs, and Uninsured Earthquake Risk. He's from R Street Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So my first question is the federal government, is this something, to your knowledge, that they think at all about?
So there's actually an interesting question on that front. Just recently, Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina and Representative Sean Duffy of Wisconsin had sent a letter over to the FHFA, who's the regulator for Fannie and Freddie, asking this specific question. And Mel Watt, the director of that agency, got back that they do not actually do any specific analysis of Fannie and Freddie's earthquake risk, which was one of the things we were looking to do ourselves in this paper.
And you calculate between $50 and $100 billion would be the price tag. How well would the federal government be able to absorb that?
So there's actually two. What we calculate in the study is the size of the mortgages that are being held by Fannie and Freddie, which is actually a lot more than that. There's about $355 billion in unpaid principal in counties that are exposed to the highest earthquake risks. And of that, we estimate about $200 billion is the value of the structures on those properties that are currently completely uninsured, having no insurance. So $50 to $100 billion is more of an estimate of how large of a loss a single large earthquake could cause.
And those homes, it's required, of course, that they have typical homeowners coverage. That's a mandate of having the mortgages. But it would be extremely difficult to mandate earthquake insurance just because the cost.
It's very costly. It tends not to be very extensive. There's a lot that remains uninsured, very large deductibles. And so, yeah, that is the case. We are not specifically proposing in this paper that the FHFA or Congress institute a mandate, certainly not in the near term. But what we do think Fannie and Freddie should look at is whether they can transfer some of that risk to the private market through purchasing reinsurance or issuing cat bonds or something along those lines.
What about the private sector on this? Because with so many of the mortgages held by private lenders, mm-hmm. what do you see as the potential fiscal impact of that?
So in the, for instance, in the commercial mortgage market, there are insurance requirements and also more stringent underwriting standards as to what mortgages can be wrapped up in a commercial mortgage-backed security. So the private market is actually doing more on that front. There are certainly risks that they still face, and that's something for their individual prudential regulators to be examining.
Yeah, I mean, my lender doesn't require that I have earthquake insurance, but the lender makes no requirement.
Yeah, and that's more or less how it works across the board in the residential market. They do require under a variety of different authorities, they require coverage for wind, for fire, for civil commotion and riots. But earthquake is a notable exception that is not required.
I'd love to hear from you as an AirTalk listener. If you're a homeowner, do you have earthquake insurance, and why or why not? Is it simply a cost-benefit analysis? Are you betting on the fact there won't be an earthquake large enough to cause major structural damage to your home, or at least beyond what the deductible would be in an earthquake policy? I welcome your thoughts on this. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with me is Glenn Pomeroy, the CEO of the California Earthquake Authority. Mr. Pomeroy, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you.
So what are some of the efforts that the authority has been making to try and get more Californians to buy the insurance?
Yeah, CEA is a not-for-profit insurer for earthquakes for homeowners, formed in the wake of the Northridge earthquake 22 years ago. After that big one, most for-profit insurance companies didn't want anything to do with this risk anymore. And so the state put this not-for-profit thing together. And for the last 22 years then, we've been working really hard to get the price of earthquake insurance just as affordable as possible while staying true to the law that also requires us to be actuarially sound. So we can't give the coverage away. State law ensures that we charge enough for the rates to be able to cover our losses. But still, because we have this public mission, we've been able to make huge strides towards making it more affordable. Actually, we've lowered rates by over 50% since we were formed, at a time when reconstruction costs, which is what we insure the home for, has gone up 170%. The long way... long way of saying, if we were just content to sit here in Sacramento with our feet on the desk and raise our rates whenever reconstruction costs went up, no one would be able to afford earthquake insurance anymore. It'd cost twice what it does today because we've had this not-for-profit scratching and clawing and trying to make rates more affordable.
I think
really improve the coverage options. And so we really got to dispel some urban myths. It's no longer the fact that it's very costly with high deductibles. That's just not the case anymore. So the way to find out how much an earthquake insurance policy is going to cost an individual is to just jump on our website, earthquakeauthority.com, plug in the particulars of the home, and then get into the calculator and play with your options. You can raise a deductible or lower it. You can add coverage or take away personal property coverage. You can control your premium to get it to where it meets your own needs and budget. It's not a one-size-fits-all deal anymore.
I think that I pay about the same for my earthquake policy through the authority as I do for my homeowner's policy. Is that fairly typical?
That's fairly typical. The average policy in our book across the state now costs about $800 a year, and that's for a reconstruction value of a home. It's going to cost us about $500,000 to rebuild. But that's an average. Costs will vary. And the biggest driver of cost is where that home sits in relation to the fault. So if you've got a home that sits smack dab on the San Andreas, you're going to be paying more to insure that home for earthquake than if that same home was in the Central Valley, for example. And that's just because of the risk is more, and our rates reflect that risk.
If more people purchase earthquake insurance, does that provide a greater buffer for the authority, or is it just commensurate that, you know, you have more money coming in, but you have more risk, too, with more houses you'd have to replace?
Great question. And it's really more of the latter. We're trying very hard to grow, and we've had a lot of success over the last couple of years. 10 years leading up to 2016, we grew on average year to year about 6,000 policies a year. But then in 2016, when we rolled out all those new coverage options, more deductibles, lower price, we grew by 52,000, almost a tenfold increase. And then the year after that, we grew by 90,000. Now, there were some things that entered into it, the big earthquake down in Mexico that happened last fall that got a lot of people to think about this and realize, hey, wait a minute, this could happen to me someday. So there, in addition to a better product at a better price, there was greater awareness created by various natural disasters. But we're growing. Now the frustrating part is if we grew really fast, and I mean faster than we've ever grown before, by even faster than last year, that would begin to put a stress then on having to increase rates a little bit so that we could manage that greater risk that we're taking on.
Hmm.
We're trying to figure out ways to deal with that, too. We want to grow. We want to protect more homes. Our public mission is to help make our cities more resilient following the next big earthquake, and we've got a lot of work to do to make progress.
We're talking with the CEO of the California Earthquake Authority, Glenn Pomeroy, joining us on Air Talk. If you have questions about earthquake insurance, we're at 866-893-KPCC. Kim writes on the Air Talk page, my insurance agent said she doesn't recommend clients get earthquake insurance unless they have more than 50% ownership equity in the house. How much is left on the mortgage is key, according to Kim's agent. Her concern was it could be cost prohibitive for most, and it's a good way to see if it has value to individuals. Glenn Pomeroy, your response to that filtering process.
I'd like Kim to just jump on the website and spend a couple minutes with a calculator and play around with the options and see how much it would cost her to protect. If she's got any equity in the home or a significant amount, it's likely one of the biggest assets she has in this life. And it kind of drives me a little crazy to hear that an insurance professional is giving advice against putting that protection in place. I'd like to ask that agent, what advice would he have for Kim the day after the big earthquake when she lost everything? Because there is no protection under the homeowner's policy. Federal assistance is extremely limited. Yes, FEMA rushes to the front line in a disaster and provides emergency assistance, which thank God they do. But the maximum FEMA grant you can get is $30,000, and it's not to rebuild homes. It's for emergency life and safety needs that take place following an earthquake. So, it's, in my opinion, she got bad advice, and I think she'd take matters into her own hands. Go to the website, check out the options that are available, and see if she can construct a product now to give her the peace of mind that also falls within the price that she can afford.
All right. We're talking with Glenn Pomeroy, California Earthquake Authority. R.J. Lehman, anything you'd like to weigh in on that we just heard from Mr. Pomeroy?
Sure. And I want to start by saying in our paper, we acknowledge the very good work Glenn has been doing in providing more options for CEA and expanding the take-up rate. They brought it up from about 10% to 13%, a little over 13%, and that was you know, a hard lift and a really good job. The concern we raise in the paper is exactly the calculation that Kim is considering here. California, like many states, is a non-recourse state, which means that your mortgage lender, if you default on your mortgage, is only entitled to your property. They can't come after you for a deficiency judgment. So if you did have a major earthquake and lost the structure, which accounts for about two-thirds of the value of the property, there are lots of homeowners who would walk away from their mortgages, and it is Fannie and Freddie overwhelmingly that would be left holding the bag for those.
All right. We'll continue our conversation, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. One of our listeners raises the issue about being able to lower the premium for earthquake insurance if you retrofit. That's absolutely true. That's something that I did with my house and was able to verify the house had been fully retrofitted, and that lowered the rate of the premium of earthquake insurance. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll take more listener calls. Then coming up later in the hour, we'll look at the ongoing controversy over injection sites for IV drug users and needle exchange programs. They've too become highly controversial in Orange County. Back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about earthquake insurance in California, where we know big quakes are in our future. We don't know when, but we know it's inevitable. The question is, what happens to the housing stock when big earthquakes strike and individuals don't have earthquake insurance? And a study that's being published tomorrow by the R Street Institute, a free market D.C.-based think tank, claims that the federal government's exposure to a major California earthquake would be as much as $100 billion through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac held mortgages. These would be homes where people have those government-backed mortgages and they don't have earthquake insurance. After a major quake, their home is seriously damaged. They just walk away because they wouldn't have the funds to rebuild or repair the house. And so economically, the better decision would just be to abandon the property. That then would cause the cost of repairs before sale to fall on the federal government. With us to talk about it is Daniel Farber, Professor of Law and Director of the Environmental Law Program at UC Berkeley. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
What are ways in which the federal government could perhaps prepare for this?
Well, this is a problem that's not completely limited to the earthquake insurance situation. Insurance for catastrophic risks has been a difficult issue in a lot of different places. California has a good program. Florida set up a program for wind insurance. But still, there are problems. For example, even with flood insurance, which the federal government requires for mortgages in some areas, it turns out that coverage take-up is really much smaller. People find ways to evade the requirements because it's expensive. And then a lot of people turn out to be outside of the flood zones, but yet their houses are damaged or destroyed by floods. So, and people, as in California, it's hard to persuade people to buy insurance for something which, you know, they figure may not happen for 20 years, or maybe they won't even own the house at all. I think this is a really valuable report in highlighting this issue for earthquakes. And I think we have a broader problem, not just with the federal funding agencies, but really with trying to manage those financial risks for people in California and other parts of the country.
Do you have any prescriptive for? I mean, you've laid out the challenge beautifully, but how would you resolve this?
You know, I wish I had a simple answer. I do think that activities like the California Earthquake Authority or Other kinds of government funds are useful. I think trying to involve the private sector in the funding insurance is helpful because sometimes it's hard for the government to price insurance. There can be political pressures to keep the premiums lower than they should be actuarially, and then people aren't really getting a good signal about the risk. It does seem like some kind of government involvement in the insurance system is critical, at least for some level of reinsurance for the worst level of disasters, because there may be limits to what the private market is able to bear. So it's a really complicated question, but it's one that we really need to start paying a lot more attention to.
We're talking with Daniel Farber, UC Berkeley, a professor of law, director of the Environmental Law Program at Berkeley. Tony writes on the Air Talk page, until 22 years ago, I had earthquake insurance through State Farm. The reason they and others stopped writing policies was a new state law mandating that they offer earthquake insurance to every policyholder in the state. Unable to adjust premiums to compensate for risk, such as in the Marina District of San Francisco, the private insurers opted to not offer insurance at all, at which point the state took over the program, resulting in expensive and god-awful insurance. What a surprise. Mr. Pomeroy was not being completely honest when he said the insurers just suddenly stopped writing policies. Glenn Pomeroy, California Earthquake Authority, you want to respond to Tony's post?
Yeah. Sure. He's close, but not close enough. Actually, the requirement to offer earthquake insurance came in before the Northridge earthquake, which was 22 years ago. The requirement to offer earthquake insurance came in the early 80s, 10 years before the Northridge earthquake happened. And for the first 10 years, insurance companies were fine with that obligation because they didn't really have a handle on the risk. Then Northridge happened. Then companies came to the legislature to try to get the legislature to drop that mandate that they offer it. The legislature refused. And then companies began to basically saying, well, if we're going to have to write earthquake insurance as a price of doing business in the homeowners market, we're going to quit selling new homeowners policies in this state. So that's the crisis that ultimately led to the creation of the California Earthquake Authority.
All right. Let me share some more listener comments. Dominic in Oak Park says, I have insurance, earthquake insurance through a private company. It has better coverage, cheaper premium than the CEA. I don't understand how the State Earthquake Authority charges more and offers less coverage. Mr. Pomeroy?
Yeah. Well, we take all comers. So our rating structure assumes the fact that if anybody wants a policy, they're going to get it from us. Other companies are more selective, so they will take risk in certain areas, they won't in other areas, and they can price accordingly. The thing I want to say, though, is because we have a public mission, we actually don't consider other carriers to be competitors. So if we're out there promoting the need for earthquake insurance and someone buys it from another company, that's a good day as far as we're concerned because we got other home protected, whether through us or somebody else. About 80% of the policies purchased in this state are purchased through us. But others can find, from time to time, a policy for them that works better from another carrier, and we applaud them for it, and we just want to get more homes insured.
We have a couple of listeners who wanted to ask about condo insurance. Julie in Palm Desert says she doesn't know if she needs it. She's heard conflicting reports from her condo association board. Richard in Hancock Park wonders, is it redundant to get condo insurance? His building does have insurance on the building itself. Mr. Pomeroy?
Yeah. So condo insurance, if the entire structure is insured with a commercial policy, that's good. What that policy will not do, though, is provide protection for the listener's individual unit. So the best scenario is to live in a condominium that the association has an association policy in place covering the common areas, and then couple that with having your own unit insured, just like you would have a condominium coverage for your stuff inside, from the paint in, basically, that you've got that covered for other losses. Pick up a separate condo earthquake insurance policy to cover that unit for the losses that you may sustain inside your unit. Also, it will provide coverage for you in case you get assessed after an event and the association gives an assessment to each condo unit owners, your CEA condo policy can kick in and cover that assessment for you. So
well, that's probably a bigger deal than even the contents of the condo.
Right.
Because those assessments, having been a condo owner, that can be big. So let's take an example in a condo. Let's say that there's a gap develops after a quake between the floor and the wall, for example, something structural like that. That would be covered through the commercial policy of the building?
Yeah, I believe that's right. Generally,
okay.
I mean, damage to the common areas.
Well, that would be in the unit, but...
If it's in the unit itself, if it's basically from the wall in... that would more than likely be on the responsibility of the condo unit owner, unless it's anyway. It's hard doing hypotheticals, but if the damage is to the overall structure, and that structure shows up in all units in the form of a crack, that probably is going to be on the commercial side or on the whole building.
Okay,
it's the damage to the individual's personal stuff that you cover with condo coverage.
All right. Let me go back to Daniel Farber of UC Berkeley. Professor, do you think that there would be any way feasibly of mandating quake insurance if the cost were lower?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think, first of all, there have been efforts to do mandates of, say, in connection with requirements for mortgages, which have had some success, although people do sometimes evade them. Lower cost would certainly make it a lot easier politically to mandate. I think the problem, you know, if you offer it at a low cost, one problem is that you may be giving people sort of the wrong signal about how dangerous the area is. There's also, of course, an affordability issue, and that's been a big problem with a lot of, say, flood insurance, too, which is that, you know, for some people, the cost of the earthquake insurance is, you know, maybe something they wouldn't prefer to pay, but something they can easily handle. But for other people, it may be a heavy burden, and we have an affordability crisis in California to begin with. So you may need to also to find ways of making it more feasible for lower income people to manage the debt. But I think in an ideal world, like fire insurance, we would definitely mandate it, at least for anybody who's got a mortgage, because you know, sooner or later, those big quakes are going to happen, and a lot of people are going to find themselves in very, very serious trouble financially and in terms of their biggest investment, their housing.
Daniel Farber, UC Berkeley, thank you very much for being with us. Glenn Pomeroy, the California Earthquake Authority, thanks so much. And R.J. Lehman of the R Street Institute, which did this study. My question for you is, what do you hope comes out of this report?
We're looking for, as Congress right now, we're just about celebrating the 10th anniversary of Fannie and Freddie being taken into conservatorship. There are efforts in Congress to move it out of conservatorship back into the private or semi-private market. We would like the FHFA and members of Congress to take this issue into consideration as they craft those plans.
All right. Thank you, sir, for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
R.J. Lehman is co-author of the report, Take a Load Off Fannie. It's from the R Street Institute, a free market-based think tank in Washington, D.C. And we'll let you comment on the, as always, on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Now, coming up next, right after the news, we're going to take a look at the ongoing controversy over a couple of public health initiatives that are aimed at IV drug users. One is needle exchanges, the idea that clean needles are provided to users so that that lowers the risk of bloodborne illnesses from contaminated needles. The other is controversy over what our government provided safe places for people to inject drugs. The idea being that if someone overdoses, they could immediately be treated. The odds that you would have a fatal overdose significantly lessened. In fact, I don't think there has been a fatal overdose at one of those places where people go to inject drugs. But there is a recent meta study which takes a look at those injection sites and concludes that they really have not been helpful where they've been in place to prevent ODs. We'll talk about that coming up. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Also remind you, when it comes to earthquakes, we are in the process of working on a new podcast called The Big One. They'd love to have your questions about earthquakes, questions about how FEMA works, or even a story you'd like to share about a big one in California. You can email the podcasting team at thebigone@kpcc.org. Back after this update from Eddie. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Ongoing controversy over a couple of different ways of creating a safer environment for IV drug users, one of which needle exchange programs. You probably heard about Orange County and Santa Ana has such a program. San Francisco has one. A number of other cities and counties have established these to try and make sure that IV drug users are using unshared clean needles. But then there are different injection sites going further, providing a place where supervised users can come in, inject themselves, if they accidentally overdose or have another health event, that they could be attended to immediately. Joining us to talk about how this controversy is playing out in Orange County is KPCC Orange County reporter Jill Replogle. Jill, good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So where do things stand on Orange County's legal fight against the Santa Ana needle exchange site?
Right. So a group of UC Irvine students started up this needle exchange in 2016. And earlier this year, it was operating out of the Santa Ana Civic Center Plaza. And earlier this year, Santa Ana, in an effort to clean up the big homeless encampment there and regulate things at the plaza, did not renew its permit. They kind of changed the rules and they had to get a permit from the city, and they denied them the permit. And so the needle exchange group went to the state to apply for a permit from the California Department of Public Health, got that permit, and immediately were slapped with a lawsuit by the county and several Orange County cities. So there's supposed to be a hearing in that lawsuit later this week. And basically, the cities and the county are arguing that they do not have a proper method for taking care of the waste that they generate by handing out needles.
And what sort of waste are they referring to, like discarded needles?
Yeah, discarded needles, right. So there have, you know, the city of Santa Ana and the county have both just received tons of complaints from residents. You know, I read some of the reports from the city about needles being left around the law library that's right there in the plaza, you know, people coming across them in walkways and in the parks nearby. Now, it's hard to disentangle the large homeless encampment that was there where there was a lot of needle use from the needle exchange.
Okay.
But in the eyes of the public, and yeah, it's kind of gotten, you know, conflated.
So is their claim that the users are getting the clean needles and then immediately injecting themselves close to the exchange site?
So first of all, the large homeless encampment that was cleared out of the Santa Ana Riverbed earlier this year. When that was done, there were reports of finding, you know, 14,000 needles there. And so that was widely reported on in the press and by the supervisors. And so a lot of people kind of picked up on that as, oh, well, you know, there's this needle exchange. This must be where people are getting their needles and, you know, tossing them around.
Okay.
And then, yeah.
So they put the two together. Okay, I got it. Jill Replogle, KPCC Orange County reporter with us. Also joining us, the vice chair of the Orange County Board of Supervisors, Sean Nelson. Sean's district includes North and Central Orange County. Supervisor, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So your concerns about allowing the needle exchanges in Orange County, what do you see as the effect on the communities involved?
Well, look, there's no secret here. This group that's been distributing needles, first and foremost, in order to even apply for that state permit, they had to have a plan for recovery and disposal of all these used syringes. They don't have any plan, not a bad one. They didn't have any plan. It was just the application. I can't even imagine how it was approved. But, you know, if you take a bare aspirin, a Tylenol, every one of those things has the name bare aspirin. Even if you take a generic, they have a name stamped on them. You know, this could be easily addressed by putting their name on these needles. It is correct. It's not, well, it was a few needles. There were thousands of needles. And this needle exchange, if you wish to use the term exchange, is no exchange at all. It's a needle giveaway. The only thing someone needs to get up to 20 needles is to find some old used needle, and they can exchange one for 20. And that's clearly what's going on. There's no incentive for people that couldn't care less to avoid them throwing these needles into public spaces. And we're not finding some needles. We're finding them by the basketful. And they are, in my view, a bigger danger to innocent random kids. We just had a huge beach cleanup at the coast this weekend, and it presents a clear danger to the public health of the average citizen. I am sensitive to these needle users. I had a close family member die as a heroin addict. I'm very familiar with this. But you cannot completely ignore the safety of the public to accommodate needle users. This is ridiculous. And these folks didn't even begin to meet the responsibility. It's outrageous.
What do you think would be an effective way to handle the discarded needle problem?
Well, first of all, if you're going to have an exchange, I speak English. The word exchange would suggest that you're bringing in 20 to get 20. And the person receiving the free needles would actually have some responsibility to not discard their needles when they use them. Bring us back five. We'll give you five. And if you have a crisis, maybe it would be appropriate, bring us eight and we'll give you five. So encourage people to pick stuff up. But at minimum, make it a true exchange and put the exchange distributor's name on each syringe, like you do on every bare aspirin and every other narcotic. I mean, you know, the manufacturers put their names and identification on very small items by the millions. It doesn't cost any extra. Identify it so we know if it's yours that's being thrown out, and take responsibility. If you're going to hand out 20, collect 20.
If they met that criteria, would you support the idea of needle exchange programs being available in the county?
Well, we already had needle exchange programs in the county, and they were a complete disaster because they left nothing but a toxic mess, you know, from head to toe in the county. So, I appreciate the hypothetical, but what we don't have is someone stepping up and showing that they're responsible and they're going to do this in a sane manner. No one believes that the word exchange means trade one for 20. And I have my doubts. I have nothing to prove it, that there are people that aren't getting needles that are exchanging zero for 20.
All right.
Because the problem, it is a danger to the rest of the citizens.
We're talking with Sean Nelson, vice chair of the Orange County Board of Supervisors. The county has filed a lawsuit against the needle exchange program in Santa Ana. Also joining us is Professor Ricky Blumenthal of University of Southern California, professor of preventive medicine. He's researched needle exchange programs. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What about what Supervisor Nelson is saying, mandating that it is a straight exchange?
Well, we've done studies, a couple now, which have documented that the more generous the syringe dispensing policy, the better outcomes you have in terms of HIV prevention and hepatitis C prevention. So, you know, people end up sharing syringes not because there's some intrinsic emotional value in that or because it's a bonding experience. They share syringes because there's insufficient clean syringes available. And having a more generous policy serves the purpose of radically reducing syringe sharing in populations, and that's been documented.
But does that benefit the user over the general public that has to deal with the discarded needles?
So we looked at that question, and what we found was that there wasn't a relationship, there wasn't a correlation between the syringe dispensing policy and improper syringe disposal. So let me just make a point about this. So I've been studying this topic or these topics since 1991, and I've been studying them down in Los Angeles since 2001. And one thing that I've observed is because of other processes, what we would call in public health the social determinants of health, the population of people who inject drugs is becoming poorer, more apt to be homeless, less engaged with services. And so you end up with these circumstances where you have improper syringe disposal because people are poor and homeless. And there are other things that you can do to facilitate proper syringe disposal, like providing biohazard containers to the community, putting them in these encampments where people are located. But you have to engage with the population around that topic. And I think there's probably a win-win here, but it would require additional resources, and it would require, putting in trash receptacles and other things to help people remove the garbage, not just the syringes, because there's all kinds of other garbage in these encampments that need to get removed.
All right. We'll continue with Ricky Bluthenthal, professor of preventive medicine, USC, Sean Nelson, Orange County supervisor with us. We have another voice from Stanford University who'll be joining us. We're talking about needle exchange as well as the even more far-reaching safe injection sites that are being talked about in a variety of different communities, San Francisco trying that, for example. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Back in 1 minute. I know you'll want to stay tuned for Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Coming up on today's program, America's favorite astronomer Neil deGrasse Tyson. His new book looks at the alliance between astrophysics and the military. DeGrasse Tyson thinks that having a space force is not a crazy idea. He'll tell us about it. He'd like to see some additions to what a space force would do, including defending the world from asteroid strikes. It's Fresh Air. Coming up, Neil deGrasse Tyson here on 89.3 KPECC. Right now, our focus on the ongoing controversies over public needle exchange programs for IV drug users, as well as safe injection sites monitored by those who could provide help in case someone gets into trouble with an injection of heroin or another substance. If you have questions for our guests, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. With us from Stanford University, Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences and Director for Mental Health Policy, Keith Humphreys. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So your thoughts about the cost-benefit analysis of needle exchange programs. Do they work as to their intended purpose?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of evidence on the value of needle exchange, particularly for reducing infections with HIV. It's harder to reduce Hep C because it's more easily transmitted, but still, HIV benefits, I think, are more than enough to justify the value of needle exchange. And there's a literature on that has been studied in cities all over the world in lots of different conditions, poor communities, wealthy communities, and everywhere in between. That doesn't mean there aren't better ways to do it. There is no service that we provide in healthcare in general that can't be improved. And, the suggestions, the discarding syringes is a problem. And I agree, with the idea of putting more opportunities out for people to dispense of sharps is a really good idea. So I just listening to the discussion that was just there, I think there are valid concerns raised, but I think there's a way to deal with those concerns at the same time maintain needle exchange in the county.
Also, I wanted to ask you about this related issue of safe injection sites going further than just clean needle exchange. Recently, there was a meta study looking at whether those supervised injection sites cut down on overdoses, and it doesn't appear from the meta study that the research backs the contention that it cuts the rate of OD. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, yeah. So what you're referring to is a meta-analysis which took the eight strongest studies in the field, a much smaller field than we have on needle exchange, to try to see if these sites reduced deaths in the population or reduced the people's likelihood to share needles or their likelihood to engage in like shooting, injecting heroin on the street. And it didn't find any benefits on any of those. So that was really disappointing. I mean, to me, too. I want, we're in the midst of a crisis. I certainly want everything we try to work. But I also am a scientist. So when I look at it as a scientist, I think, could be that these are not that good an investment. Either they don't have the effects promised, or maybe the effects are quite small. And therefore, to me, it makes sense. If I were allocating a budget, I'd be more inclined to put public health dollars into things like, say, buprenorphine maintenance, which is a treatment for people who are addicted to heroin that we know for sure works, and we know for sure we don't have enough of, and we know for sure helps people a lot, as opposed to something like this that may or may not actually have the benefits that we hope it does.
Professor Bluthenthal of USC, what do you think of the meta-analysis on safe injection sites?
Well, I think there's some technical issues, problems with the publication, including the fact that they combine different kinds of outcomes to make their calculation, which is pretty problematic in terms of assessing its effects. But I think the other piece is, I like what Dr. Humphrey said about budgets. I mean, one of the things that's true about all of the topics around health promotion for people who inject drugs is that we actually spend very little on that. And particularly for these things, even like the syringe service programs or needle exchange programs, the contributions of county governments and state governments to those activities remain quite low. So you end up not always getting the intended effects because they're not implemented fully. So in terms of the supervised injection facilities, as someone who studied the topic for 30 years from the perspective of homeless drug users, they're pretty perfect, actually, in terms of the causal claim of when you're in that facility and you're using, you're not going to die.
The question is whether it's a self-selecting sample, though, whether those who are least at risk of ODing are the ones who would go to the safe injection sites.
The truth is the data we have from published studies about this show that it's the opposite. And we saw the same thing with syringe exchange programs. I mean, the people who use these are the most disadvantaged people. And if you've been in Vancouver, where the facilities, it's in the downtown east side, and you see who's going in. It's pretty obvious that there are folks who are pretty in tough shape. And so I think the truth is they attract the people who need it. So I think the self-selection bias claim is spurious.
Ricky Bluthenthal, professor at USC. Let me go back to Orange County Supervisor Sean Nelson. Supervisor, you've heard this conversation since a few minutes ago. So your thoughts about this, really a matter, the experts claim, of just, much better job of collecting of the used needles and more resources into this?
Well, listen, I mean, I appreciate it. I'm a Trojan, so I appreciate the effort going through, all the studies, but the practical aspect is not whether in an academic setting that you could get a result. There's an impact to society, and in this case, the state law requires, not suggests, requires that the person giving away needles has a plan to recover those needles. And in our circumstance, as I mentioned before, they didn't have a bad plan. They had no plan at all. And the state didn't even look at that as if, it's in the state law, but no one's going to follow it. What no one is dealing with, and I listen to the two professors, and they sound like very distinguished gentlemen. However, there's no discussion of any accountability on the user's end. And, we're not coming out with a big stick to punish people, but there has to be this idea that society is not going to keep hiring yet another cleanup guy. San Francisco has a whole team of people. We're not going to keep piling on because someone can't get their act together and get a personal needle carrier that's safe to dispose of needles. And
supervise
your own darn needles and bring them back, and we'll give you a new one. I have no problem with theft. A lot of people do.
Supervisor, I'm out of time, but I thank so much for being with us. That's Sean Nelson, is vice chair of the Orange County Board of Supervisors, his district in North and Central Orange County. From all of us at AirTalk, have a terrific afternoon. Fresh air is next.